Travis, I'm a recovered alcoholic and drug addict. And thank you, Chris, for that introduction. Sounds pretty good when somebody else says it. I'm a little bit nervous, and I hate when people say they're nervous when they start a thing, but I'm nervous. I've sat down and thought I would. Chris asked me to do this, and I sat down a few times with a pen and paper, kind of trying to outline what I was going to say. And can y'all hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then something would happen. I'd get up and wander off. So then I took a nap, and then I drank a bunch of coffee. So and then the Cowboys lost. I figured if they won. Well, I thought if they won, you'd like me a lot better, but, so, I was born to two alcoholics, and, I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. My family's from Austin, but they moved up there, and I was born there to two alcoholics, and, they got sober when I was about, they got divorced, but they both got sober when I was about 12. And, you know, I had this, you know, from an early age, I had this spiritual part of it. I already was always afraid. I was an only child. I wanted everyone to like me. I didn't fit in, all that stuff. And I took my first drink right about the time they got sober. So that was kind of bad news for them because, you know, I was at a friend's house, snuck into the liquor cabinet, took, you know, mixed like 15 things. It had like Kahlua in it and amaretto. I can still taste it. And it was enough, but it had the alcohol in it. And, you know, it did the thing that we know it does for us. And I remember being really worried because I knew, you know, I threw up and all that. And, but it, you know, there was that period in there that night where it relieved all of my fears. It made me whole again. And it did for me what I could never do for myself. And, but I was really, it gave me anxiety the next day because I knew that it was screwed up that I was 12 or 13 and I was going to have to figure out how to get this all the time. And in the first world is not easy for a 13-year-old to get booze, especially when your parents are sober. And so I spent the next few decades working on that. And you know, we would do the usual stuff. You know, we had cab drivers that would buy it for us and would sit outside of liquor stores in the wrong side of town and pay somebody to buy us booze. And life goes on. And the normal bad stuff, so the consequences started adding up as I got into my 20s. I was accumulating DWIs and injuries and... my parents were always there pushing AA on me, and you know, so AA was never a mystery to me. It wasn't like, oh, these weird classes you go to. I knew exactly what it was. I was going to Alateen meetings, and these kids in the Alateen meetings would be whining because their daddy had hidden a bottle of whiskey under the porch, and I thought, man, if I found that, I would drink it. You know, what am I doing in here? And, I didn't know what an alcoholic was for years, but I knew there was something. I thought I had really bad luck. And I thought for years I thought that I was cursed. And I literally went to witch doctors in Mexico. You know, there's just the amount of bad things that happened to me. It just didn't happen to the normal person. And, I couldn't hold a job down for long. I couldn't keep a relationship together. For some reason, I would get a DWI, but I was on the side of the road with a flat tire. And I was two blocks from my house. And I told the cop when he walked up, I go, look, man, I can't get a DWI. But I've been drinking. And he just said, get in my car. And took me to jail. But I was like, man, I'd hit a curb with my headlights not on, driving down Camp Bowie in Fort Worth at nighttime with no headlights on in a rainstorm and just ran right over a curb. And he saw the whole thing from the 7-Eleven. But so I would, you know, kind of plea bargain my way with my folks and family because they were my, you know, being good, they were very good at AA but horrible at Al-Anon. And I was their only child, so I was the black sheep, and I was also the best they had. So I was their only hope. You know, it's like, you know, other kids were like, you know, going to West Point and stuff, and I was at a witch doctor in Mexico or something. And so they'd be like, oh, he's exploring. He's kind of adventurous. So I would go, yeah, I'll go to AA, you know, and can I just live with y'all for a while? I'll get a job and go to AA. And I'd go to meetings and I'd get a sponsor. And the steps were just no way. Like, that was for, like, people that were hardcore. And the Big Book, I really thought for many years, was something you sort of did on the side, sort of to read about the history of, like, what our forefathers did, you know, to, like, if you really got interested in it. But otherwise, I'd go to meetings and check out the girls and smoke cigarettes and go do coffee. But, man, I could string together a good amount of time. And by that, I mean, like, 3 months. But there came a point where, you know, without the alcohol, once I could clean up good, you know, I could just get me out of jail and cleaned up and fed, and I could go ace a job interview and get things going. But the real problem was inside, internally, I started getting worse. You know, I started getting crazy, and I started realizing how the world was so messed up, and you're not acting right. And if only this and only that, I could be happy. And I was plagued with that. And I eventually was able to... I was on a nice bender where I ended up on a... I was going down. A buddy of mine was in Costa Rica, and he was working down there, and he said, come on down here, and you can work with me. And I thought, that'll be easy. And I got on a plane at DFW, and somehow I got in hold of $1,000. That was my nest egg to get me started down there. I say somehow, I mean I begged my father for it. And I mean, I'm on a plane, and there's nowhere you can go once you're on a plane. All I had to do was get to San Jose, Costa Rica, and I woke up in a hotel room in Guatemala, which is only halfway there. And this was a direct flight. And I was like, and I didn't know for like 2 hours what country I was in. Like, I opened the door, opened the window, and there's like Spanish everywhere. And I was like, this might be Costa Rica. And I had to get a phone book out, and I figured out I was in Guatemala City. That scared me. But that was normal. I mean, that had been happening all my life. Lots of blackouts. And I only had like $200 left. So I've come to figure out the plane had an issue and they landed. I'd gotten off. I'd been drinking since the airport in Fort Worth. So I stayed off the plane. I was going to check out Guatemala. Eventually made it to Costa Rica. I was in real... Once you get out, like, I mean, nobody was around. I could drink the way I wanted to. There was no probation officer. There were nobody hassling me. And was in a Jeep with a buddy, and we went over a cliff. and I destroyed myself physically, and it was a horrible accident. I thought I was going to die, and I was ready to die. I was in a little bitty Red Cross clinic, and I heard them scrubbing his wounds with these wire brushes they do down there so you won't get worms and stuff in them. And I heard that, and I went in the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and my eyebrow was hanging off. And I took some tape, and I taped it back on, and I crawled out the window and went back to this house we were squatting in, and just laid down to die. And I had a bucket to throw up in because I was hurt internally and just figured I'd die. And I was prayed for days asking God for forgive me. And I got scared because I started getting better. And this lady that I worked with finally found me. And she came in, and this is an American woman down in Costa Rica, and she was worked with us where we worked, and she came in, and turned out she was an AA and ran the local gringo AA meeting that had four members or something, and took me to her house and got me better and took me to meetings, and I got better, and I'm in paradise. So they aren't working the steps down there at the time. It's just not happening. A couple of them were, but they were weird. But my people were just like going to a lot of meetings and surfing. So I hung out with them. And life was easy. And I had it. And I got like 2 years that way. And I, you know, everything was good. So I figured I was ready to move back to the United States. I moved to Los Angeles, California, over a girl. And immediately, life got a little bit more complicated in L.A. than it was in the coastal regions of Costa Rica. And I got really good work. I was working hard. I started getting this cool life. And I knew I couldn't drink. I knew that. I was really scared. I knew what was going to happen if I didn't drink. But I'd kind of hurt my knee. You know what I mean? And my neighbor, and I lived in Venice, and he had a huge opiate addiction and a supply of opiates. And I started dabbling in that. And before long, I was addicted, and then I had to move on, work around in the opiate world. But what I did, you know, it's like I'm a drug addict and I'm an alcoholic. I just use drugs to manage my alcoholism. I don't know. Like, it was just another, it's all the same to me. I don't see any difference. Except one just, I don't know, one's harder the next day. And I became a professional dope kicker. Because I didn't want that. You know, I was always sick. I was either sick, I was just sick. I was dope sick all the time. Or I was afraid of being dope sick. That was my whole life. And I was working to manage that. And I got married. I was so dishonest. My dishonesty in this was I was still going to AA meetings and you know, with a $100 habit in the morning. And I got, you know, I got married to this poor girl. And she had no clue, you know, but what she was dealing with. And that lasted about 4 months. But I was so good. And I went back down to Costa Rica, and I knew how to kick. And I kicked good, had it back, was doing well, moved back to L.A. And I'm so good at doing the dance that I start working in the treatment industry. You know, and in L.A., you can get paid pretty good for that. And I was getting paid a lot of money to help other people stay sober. And I'm, you know, but I'm crazy. I'm not, there might not be any chemicals in me, but I am insane. Start what they call it, stark raving sober. just full of fear, full of anxiety, resentments I don't know what to do with, trying to keep other people sober. And one night, I was walking out of a 7-Eleven, and I turned, there was this homeless guy out there, and I knew he could get me some dope. And that set me off on my final 6 months of going over to the stimulant world. And that took me down to the end. And it went from I was working in recovery. Oh, and I kept working in recovery, you know, and then ducking into an alley to hit a pipe. And because I needed the money. What am I going to do, quit? Like, hey, I'm using again. Don't pay me any money. That's crazy. So eventually, Shoreline Crips were going to kill me. And I had to run back to Texas. And I agreed to go to treatment up in North Texas. And I went to a treatment center up there for 30 days. I felt great. Everything's working great. And I know all this stuff. You know, I've been to thousands of AA meetings. I've been in the treatment world. I knew more than the counselors that were my counselor. Probably not, but I used to say that, but now looking back, I probably didn't. I'm voted most likely to succeed. You know, I'm just like the golden boy of treatment. And everyone's cheering, and it's great, and it's the 30th day, and all I got to do, and I'm just on top of the world. Finally, my parents are talking to me again. I still have a car. We somehow had it shipped back from L.A., and, I used to rent it out for, you know what I mean? So, and so it had, like, thousands in damage. It's total, they say, you know? Like, why they would do that? Yeah, and so I got the car back. I've got this old laptop. I'm going to go try to get to my sober house in Dallas. And that night, I'm going to drive back and pick up my buddies because we could come and go from there to meetings. It was weird. And but like you could go with an outsider and just take off and sign out. So I was going to come back and get my sober buddies, and we were going to go to a meeting. And I got on the expressway, and I'm in front of a liquor store all of a sudden. And I'm crying. Because I couldn't not go in. And, Jesus. It's really not that big a deal. And I didn't understand that. Because then I thought, well, man, there's something really wrong with me. I just got out of treatment. Like, what the fuck? How messed up am I? And you know, that's just to get enough courage there where I can find another part of town where I can trade that laptop for what I really want. And I just remember there's a guy with a pump shotgun. And I traded that thing for something that would last 10 minutes. And I had to. And, that went 2 or 3 weeks. That's all I had in me. And I somehow ended up back at my folks' house. And my folks at this point, they were actually divorced when I was 12. They remarried each other when I was 25. And my father was just done, like a normal person. And my mother's just crazy Al-Anon. Just one more shot. And she's in there Googling treatment centers, and they find this place, Austin Recovery. And somebody gets me in and gets me a bed. And I'll do whatever. I want to get out of there because I think my dad might kill me. And but I love my father. And but we were at this point for years, we on the outside, we hated each other. I was shuffling through the, with my bag of stuff, and my father looked at me and he said, I'll always love you, but I'll never look at you the same. And he turned and walked away. And that, for some reason, I mean, he'd said a lot of bad stuff, but for some reason that really hurt. I thought that was kind of rude. And but it hurt. Like, don't you, shouldn't you give me a little speech or some shit? Like, trying to help myself here. So I get down here. Oh, they say it's the ranch. Do they still call it the ranch?
Yeah.
So I thought, like, you're going to work with horses and stuff. And we would, like, maybe do some hay cutting and, like, some physical exercise and maybe, you know, commune with the horses. Because that's supposed to be good, the equine therapy. And they vanned me out here. And it was just dudes out here then. This is my sober date's July 28th, 2007. So. And it was, you know, the hot of heat of Texas, July 28th. And I got out here, and it was all only dudes. And it was a little bit more run down. Like, this is nice. And but I loved it. You know, it was awesome. Like, I just was tired and hungry. You know, you need to sleep for a while. And we started having these, you know, what are 10,000-calorie meals and... And I signed up for the 90-dayer because of what happened at the last place. It was like, maybe we should try something different with the and I knew, I mean, I was afraid of myself. You know, it became pretty clear that me on my own for a few hours, you know, it was just that Dr. Jekyll, whatever, Mr. Hyde thing. And I wanted to be locked up. I wanted fences. I wanted to be like Sling Blade. You know, I needed wires on a door or a window with like maybe some fields I could look at and we could play checkers. And I was ready for that. Like, that was fine with me because I'll stop hurting my family. Stop stealing my mother's wedding ring to pawn. And I came in and I you know, we sat in here, we faced this way, and these guys would come out and talk, and it was like, man, I've worked in treatment centers and I've been to 1,000 AA meetings, and these guys started coming out. But for some reason, whatever, I mean, this is crazy, but like, I think at the time, like in Austin, there was a whole bunch of step recovery, and that didn't going on everywhere. I mean, I don't know, but I've been in places where there's just not a lot. It's more like, hey, let's hang out at meetings, and that's great, whatever. And they started talking about the steps a lot. Charlie Parker used to come out here, and another guy. And they were talking about the third step. It was like my third or fourth day. And they started talking about this spiritual stuff from the big book. You know, all that stuff in the third step about trying to manage the world and direct everything and trying to get what you want and trying to get happy by managing. And all that stuff was really familiar sounding. And I thought, and I was so ignorant, and that I was like, what is he, is that like some Buddhism stuff he's bringing in from the side? Like, because it sounds cool. Like, it sounds like some weird stuff. He's like, no, it's in the big book. And I was like, I'd like to know more about that. So I grabbed a guy that had been out here, and I asked him to take me through the steps. And because I figured I'd tried everything else in AA but the steps. So why not? I doubt it'll work. But I had nothing else to do. I was going to be here 90 days, and it was hot. So I started working the steps, and, you know, I'm just going to share my experience. Another thing I started doing a lot was I started meditating right off the bat. I had a book that was about meditation, and... I just did what it said. I meditated every day as much as I could, and I started working the steps. I wanted to be pretty far along before I hit the ground out there, because of what happened. And I lined myself up with a sober house with some dudes that had gotten out before me. They kind of came and recruited me, and I did my 90 days. I loved it here. I really loved it here. I didn't want to leave. And that's not everybody's experience, but that's my experience. And I had a trash bag of my clothes, and I had maybe $12 any given day. This is the way my life is for months when I got out, and I'm in a sober house, and I realized, you know, I had that trash bag, I had a toothbrush, I had enough, I had like a dollar to put in the basket that night. Gas was expensive at the time. I could probably had enough gas to get to the meeting, but I was happier than I'd ever been in my life. And like I was happy, like in a weird way. I wasn't all blissed out, but I was just happy and I was content. And that seemed really strange because I was always either super happy or pissed off and freaked out. And what I thought happy was, I later figured out was just relief. You know, it was like, oh, I found some money. But I started getting this other weird feeling. It was just this content. The fears were falling away. All that stuff and the promises started happening. And it was sort of a carrot on the stick thing. And I just was like, I want more of this. And I continued with the steps. And I started sponsoring as soon as I could. Bless their hearts. And I lived in a sober house for a year. And, you know, like Chris talks about, like life, you know, then life happens. And my life got bigger and bigger. I'm following another girl to New York because nobody told me not to. And she's an awesome girl. Met her in sobriety. She's a great girl. And I moved to Manhattan sober with no job, $1,000. And was able to live and survive and get jobs and have a fun life. And New York's not my thing. Eventually, the relationship didn't work out. And I didn't have to get high or kill anyone. And she didn't either. You know, it was like the first grown-up breakup I'd ever had. And I thought, you know, we just like sat down and talked about it. And we're like, you know, we're growing separate ways. And I want to do this and you want to do that. Let's move on. And that seems very strange, but I think that's what normal people do sometimes. And it's important. Like, I want to go back to when I got in here that first day, I was at the point where I had flipped my mind. My mind had changed so much through drugs and alcohol that I thought that whole thing about wanting to be locked up, it was like I felt like there was this permanent change where I literally couldn't sit in a room. You know, and I would see, you know, I don't remember these things very well now, but I know that I would sit and think about, I could turn that into some sort of drug-using apparatus, you know, and whoa, what's that on the ground? And it was always that way. What kind of watch is that on the counter? Because I'll pawn that. I just didn't have, I saw money. Money was a trigger for me. Cash was a trigger. Everything made me think about it. And I thought, well, I'm screwed. I mean, that's the world. Like, what am I going to do? Like, everything I look at is a pipe. And, you know, I couldn't drive past a garage. I drive past a garage, and I'm like, there's the lawnmower. There's $50. There's whatever. And I'm like, that's screwed. Nobody's that screwed up. Like, some of y'all might be kind of screwed up, but that's pretty messed up. And so I had I realize now that moment, that liquor store when I was crying, that was my real first step experience of realizing what it's like to be powerless over that first drink. You know, it was up close and personal. And this obsession I had, and people would start talking about these 10-step promises or just having this obsession removed from you. Like, what does that look like? And because I didn't want this burden. I didn't want sobriety to be a fight. I had no more fight in me, because I used to fight the drink and the drug, and you had a pocket full of people's phone numbers and all this stuff. But when it was on, none of that mattered. That was bullshit. That didn't work for me. Maybe it worked for you, but my experience was, no matter what my consequences, when that mental blank spot hits, they talk about, it's going to happen. And that's that whole, I don't have, my willpower is insufficient, and I have plenty of willpower. I walk 9 miles barefoot for dope. That's willpower, right? And so it isn't an issue of willpower. But I was really worried about that part. This, I'm always, you know, what about this brain? All it does, it's programmed. And it's important because I would go to meetings and I would hear people say, and this is fine. Everybody has their own experience. But I would hear people at meetings, we would go to meetings in vans and whatever, and there'd be some guy over on the side and he'd say, he'd have like 20 years of sobriety. And he'd be like, I went to a family reunion and they were drinking and I got freaked out and wanted a drink, so I ran to a meeting. And I thought, shit. I mean, is that what it's going to be like? Like, that's kind of not really. And then another guy would say, I worked the steps and the obsession's been removed. And I can do whatever I want. I can serve alcohol at Thanksgiving to my family and it's not a problem. So I sort of was weighing those out too. That's another reason I tried out the steps. And I have to say, you know, that gave me some hope. And I can say with all honesty, you know, I lost the obsession. The obsession was gone when I left. And there were weird things would crop up, but I had some pretty good guys around me in my sober house. And I was, was surrounded with a lot of recovery. I put myself right in the middle. And I was following Chris around like a duckling. It was embarrassing. The funny thing, I remember, like, I'd go see Chris at Bolden in the morning, tell his story, and he'd say something real clever, and I'd run over to Westlake and say it. Like, so sorry about that. Like just screwed up. And whatever, I was having fun. And I do want to say that, you know, as bad as that obsession was, and everything I looked around was an apparatus for drugs or to sell and liquor stores and all that, like, I have not had the urge ever to use or to drink. I never think about drugs. I never think about alcohol. And that's important I say that. I'm not bragging. I'm just saying, like, because when I heard somebody say that, I was like, holy shit, maybe there's hope. Like, I just never think about it. I don't fight it. I serve alcohol in my home. When people come over for dinner, we have a bottle of wine. We get down and give it to them. And it's not around. I mean, the only time I talk about drugs is with a sponsee or at a meeting or something. And that it was lifted for me. And I just have to say that. And that's a crazy thing to happen. I mean, based on my experience of what I thought who I was, it'd be like having a giant tumor. And then wake up one day and it's not there. It was that weird. You know, it's just invisible. There was a whole bunch of other stuff that was a lot better, I was going to say, but I forgot that stuff. I just wanted to end with, you know, that guy, my father, who took a while to get used to the fact that I was sober. I made my first amends to him when I got out. And he stayed at a hotel downtown. And I went down and saw him. And I started, he was asking me how treatment was. And he was like, boy, you got a lot of amends. I was like, whoa, buddy. He's like, God. He's like, you got way more than I had. And I was like, he's like, I don't know how you're going to do it. I was like, shit. And, but, you know, and he's got like 30 years or something now. But today, he's my best friend. And that guy hated me. And I hated him because of all that weird stuff that's pre-4-step stuff. And, you know, working the steps, I got to learn about what really happened and what I thought happened. And continually, as I get older and more years under me, every year my story changes. You know, 1997 looks a lot different now than it did 4 years ago. It's just everything, the perspective change. The reality sinks in. And, you know, my father will call me today from Fort Worth and we'll meet in Hamilton, Texas, so he can run through some inventory with me. You know, he respects my sobriety, which is just super cool. And I'll end with, there's no way I could have there's just no way I would be here if it wasn't for the ranch and the steps and for Chris Gates. So thank you for listening.